Welcome to Trauma from the Frontline. My name is Bruce Perham. I'm a counsellor who has provided counselling and training to correction officers and frontline responders for over 15 years. In this series, I will be interviewing a wide range of psychologists who work in the trauma field, key stakeholders in the emergency sector, and frontline workers who have experienced mental health and at times trauma reactions due to the field in which they work. Hi, this is Bruce Perham here from Trauma from the Frontline. Today, my guest person being interviewed is Dr. John Finch, who's a clinical psychologist and director of the Centre for Clinical Psychology based in Carlton, I think. Welcome, John. Thank you so much for giving up some of your holiday time to come in and talk to me. I really do appreciate it. And probably good spot to start is be how you started out in the industry and some of your early experiences of working in the psychology field. I'd love to hear it.
Okay, thanks for asking me to come in, Bruce. I started out in psychology with the veterans after an initial taste, if you like, in my studies, where I went into a hospital where veterans were being treated, and became interested in this sort of post-trauma experience. So I worked at what at the time was called Veterans and Veterans Families Counselling Service. It's now changed its name to Open Arms, which is a specific agency for people who've been through a war zone or done deployment of some sort. I worked for them for about 5 or 6 years, I think. Then I moved on to a brief stint in the corporate field in the trauma area, turning up to post-trauma incidents before I moved on to Victoria Police, working there in their clinical psychology team, leading that. And now I work in a private practice which is all focused on trauma, really, which I like.
Now, I'm actually interested in all of those areas of where you've worked. Maybe if we start with the Open Arms or the work with the veterans, so if we look at over the first 2 to 3 years there, what sort of impressions did you start to gather about sitting with the ex-military or current military and seeing their level of psychological distress? What were some of those early impressions like?
Well, there's a high level of psychological distress. At that time, there was a limited number of sort of treatment options. And there was also a fairly high level, for want of another word, lacking of understanding of what was going on for a lot of the veterans, even though, a lot of them had something going on for quite some time. They weren't able to identify it. Clearly, families didn't kind of really know. And so they'd experience a lot of distress, a lot of withdrawal. And you'd sort of see a little bit of difference for younger veterans compared to older veterans. The younger people were kind of more agitated, more kind of hyper-aroused. The older people, maybe the way you'd kind of describe it in lay terms, were a bit more burnt out. Mm. And so a lot of them were kind of just struggling along from, week to week, not really understanding what was going on. And I guess you also saw a lot of that experience where there was a lack of acknowledgement of where their trauma had come from or where their distress had come from, like their service, and that not being appreciated. That sort of thing was a big part of the experience for veterans, particularly the Vietnam veterans. I think that's maybe less so now, but certainly that was something that you could see they had for a long time, had difficulties because nobody kind of acknowledged the work that they'd done, so to speak, or where the trauma had come from.
So, and I often, when we look at where we're at now, which we've probably also still got a long way to go, that lack of awareness or lack of preparation about what you were stepping into. So I can imagine for all of those people that went to Vietnam that there would have been a lot of training around what you need to do in a war situation, but very little about how you might psychologically react to that. Was that, in a way, your impression that these officers had no idea that that they would, as we look back now, you would expect them to react in that way.
Yeah, they had no idea of, of sort of, I guess, what to expect. I think the old sort of toughen up, you're in the military and off you go was very much part of that. Yeah, so they didn't really have a knowledge of what post-trauma responses might be.
So how did you find when they started to interact with someone like yourself where, you know, obviously a part of that is helping them to get some connection with that. What were some of your early experiences of that process of, I'm in a mess, but I don't know why?
I think a lot of it, a lot of that, the sort of early engagement with veterans in maybe the eras are kind of an important kind of part of that, where Vietnam veterans are a little bit different to the veterans now who do have a bit more kind of knowledge of yes. things. So kind of naming something was, what is this and what does it mean? But also there's a lot of difficulty with, am I allowed to talk about this? Because I've been in a war zone, I'm not supposed to talk about that. And some of them who'd been on operations that were not known were kind of citing, well, I think the Secret Service Secrecy Act means that I can't say anything. And so to get them to open up was actually, quite difficult because it was potentially layered. A lot of it was about being a man of a certain generation.
Yes.
Which still seems to apply to men of this generation too. But it was, you know, man of a certain generation plus the complexities of the military group where we don't kind of talk about our feelings, and then kind of layered upon that, am I allowed to talk about this? I might be breaking some rules if I do that. And they're all, you know, used to following rules because that's part, yes. part of the job.
Yeah, so it's almost, I hadn't really thought of that before, it's almost 100% confidentiality, even what I feel or emotionally feel, I'm not at liberty to express. So that totally supports that. We'll lock it up then, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And is that what you found, that when officers did actually start to talk, that it's almost like containing the emotion become such a difficult thing to do?
Yes, I guess that, yeah, they do have, a bit of a range, I suppose. There are some who do have, the majority, have a great difficulty of wanting to contain it and it kind of leaking out, if you yes. like. And then you get the sort of more kind of occasional ones who are kind of desperate to just get all the emotion out, but not necessarily kind of process it too much. So, you know, they kind of, for want of another word, dump it all out, get a sense of relief, but maybe don't kind of really examine it. That's one of the experiences that sort of, I guess, sort of stayed with me, that there were this kind of group that would just, yep, outpouring, but not kind of process it, not get into it too much. And then a lot who it was just all kind of, I don't know about this and I'm trying to hold on to it, it's kind of coming out. I'm finding it really scary that it's coming out. I mean, the majority of the times they do keep a lid on it, if you like. Not a lid, well, a loose lid, you know.
I guess it's my sense is that, what's the word, the explosiveness of letting it out, you know, because sometimes, you know, and you sit with people and they tell you what they've been through, you think, my God, you know. That I can kind of get how that's really hard to let that out. I mean, is that sort of, if I do start to let it out, I'm not going to be able to control it anymore, and I've been taught to control it, you know, I have to try and keep a lid on it.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, yeah. That fear of if I let some out, it's just going to keep going, it's going to cascade, it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and, you know, I'm going to get depressed or I'm going to get anxious or something bad's going to happen, I'm going to lose control.
Yeah.
Those sort of things are very big.
So as a psychologist, when, you know, that people express the emotion but you don't feel they're really kind of processing it or connecting with it, how is that for you as a psychologist, you know, to sort of think, okay, we've got the first step, but would you call it a resistance to go any further, or how would you, you know, what were your thoughts about what do I do with this?
So I guess my thoughts are often around they are around my thoughts. My thoughts are about, this person's told me something. It started. That's good, but maybe there's something more. And then my thoughts are about, am I going to hold back, or am I going to kind of push forward? And often I'm actually telling myself I need to push forward, not hold back. I'm trying to, that'll just feed into what's going on for them anyway, because everybody's probably been holding back around them and worrying about them, but actually they've been managing this stuff for years anyway. So kind of pushing forward is something that I really kind of, okay, I need to keep aware of that and explain that to them and kind of say, look, yeah, I can see that you've told me something here that's important. I'm feeling like there's a bit more there though. And, can we kind of move forward on this? How do we do that in a way that's, safe for you and, feels like you can trust me with that sort of thing? Because I guess my thoughts in that kind of process are also about, sometimes that letting stuff out, there's one level of, it's cathartic if you like, but then on the other side there can be that sort of like, oh, I've said too much, and the shame shuts everything down and they don't want to come back. So it's sort of this balance of how do we move forward to kind of understand the story that's kind of stuck there, and to keep going with that, to get more of the feelings, to get to the feelings that might often be kind of blocked behind the fear of talking about it, and how do we kind of move forward with that in a way that kind of is helpful for them, but is actually moving forward, not kind of stepping back. Because I think it's very easy to hold back and be thoughtful, kind, that sort of thing, but that doesn't actually help.
Not actually get anywhere.
And,
it's, I love going off on red herrings, but to me, I'm not a psychologist, but there seems great confusion in the psychology field about, do you, go towards trauma stories, or as you said, just leave it alone, don't go there. And I think there's great confusion to me. There seems great confusion from an EAP point of view. You mentioned critical incident, if we go into a critical incident, that's meant to be psychological first aid. Don't bring up the trauma. And yet the trauma happened the day before or 3 days ago. People want to talk about it. I've always had the personal belief that if people are comfortable to share something, I might not be asking them, but they share it. I don't have an issue with that, but other people would. So just your thoughts around that, of the sharing of the trauma, and then as a therapist, what's important for you in that process?
So like the sharing of the trauma, trauma focus is I think the biggest factor that helps. And in terms of the sort of main trauma-focused therapies that have the most research on them, that's EMDR, prolonged exposure, and cognitive processing therapy, they all have a focus on the trauma in some way where you go into a lot of detail and talk about it. That does take care of, so to speak, avoidance, which for PTSD is the thing that actually keeps it all going, where people steer around it in so many ways. And I think it's really easy for therapists to be kind, thoughtful, and you can do therapy for a really long time, but you're probably not necessarily doing therapy. You're supporting a person. And when you do this approach to the thing that they're avoiding, there is this thing that changes for people that's quite significant. I had a guy who he explained it in terms of he had his trauma working as a security guard, and he immediately went and got counselling. I said go once a week, he'd feel good for that, and it was absolutely helpful, he said. But when he came and did a trauma focused therapy, it changed the way he understood the trauma. Rather than kind of helping him with his emotions each week, it changed the way he understood the trauma, and that was really significant for him.
Well, it's just such a critical point of, so I was thinking when you were talking before, often people say, well, they had the release of the emotion and, cried the whole session, but a week later they felt the same, of the avoidance, because kind of touched on before, you know, naturally traumatic memories, you'd like to avoid them if you could, but are you actually going to start to recover if you do avoid them? And look, just a comment for anyone listening to our conversation, because I'm sure there will be people that will be listening that have PTSD, have maybe struggled with whether they need to get help or not. It's just such an important point about we all will try and avoid stuff that's painful, and yet longer term recovery might really mean we need to touch that. And I get that point of, but to do that in a trauma-focused way, which is different to talking to your neighbour. Now, John, you moved on from that work and you mentioned that you moved on to the police force. Obviously, by then, you were very interested in the trauma field because you've jumped from one trauma field to another. Yep. I'd be really interested in the move from the military type scenario into working with the police, just some of the differences of what you were seeing.
Well, actually, there weren't a lot of differences. And, you know, I think that first responder sort of culture is something that's important. I guess I was seeing more people who were on active duty, if you like, compared to veterans who were had finished their service. So I guess that there was a lot more immediacy wanting something to be different, but the difficulties of trying to change while you're also doing work and sometimes re-exposed to those things.
Yes.
Overall, the sort of difficulties in terms of I need to control my emotions to do the job, you know, that's if I feel something, I won't be able to do the job. Those sort of things were very, very similar. Younger, more females, that was also part of it. And part of it was the dynamics of an organisation that has all its difficulties, like many organisations. Mm-hmm. So, but in terms of, you know, not talking about your feelings, needing to focus on the work, managing through kind of having a drink or you know, sort of taking time off but not actually kind of doing anything active to look after yourself, those things were very similar. I'm just trying to think. I can't think of anything that sort of stands out as a major difference. The similarities is what stands out. And when I think about some of the police members I've seen, there are a number of police members who go from military to police force, and then a number of people who go from, you know, from like Victoria Police to the AFP or other way around, those sort of things. So I guess, you know, people who are used to that first responder culture, maybe they are in these organisations, and that's something that's kind of good for them in one way, but also might actually sometimes be not so good.
Well, I get, you know, that captures the dilemma of you know, this is the work I do, and this, you know, this is what I'm identify myself as, a correction officer, police officer, you know, a fiery or in the military, so that it becomes, well, that's who I am. And I get what you're saying, so that if that's sort of threatened in some way, or I'm starting to feel emotional about what I'm experiencing, but this is my career, that these sorts of dilemmas. Some comments around that, because for first responders, it is that repetition of the exposure to trauma. So I can really get the difference of, well, you've been in war, but you're now back here, but you've still got all those psychological reactions from war, whereas with the police and first responders are experiencing these things every day. What thoughts around, you know, somebody seeking therapy, but they're still going back and continuing to be exposed to the trauma. What are your thoughts?
Well, the first thing I'd say is it's absolutely not a barrier, and that, like, the research shows, certainly around cognitive processing therapy, that people can go through treatment, feel better, and go back into a job that they love.
Yes.
with all the risks that many of the civilians of the world look at and go, I wouldn't do that, but, you know, people in those jobs love those jobs. And you know, it's absolutely not a barrier. It often is the practicalities that, and this sometimes surprises me, but it's the practicalities of, can I find the time to get to an appointment? And things that you would think, why does that stop you? But it does, and it's family life and it's juggling all those things. And with the sort of ongoing exposure, once they start to learn how to manage their emotions and engage with their emotions in that, okay, yes, this is a bad thing and it does feel bad and I can still do my work and have those emotions, the sort of re-exposure idea doesn't become a problem. There's often, you know, I might have to stop to do this, that sort of thing, but it's not necessarily the case. It's actually just making the commitment to, I'm going to turn up for therapy, I'm going to do the stuff in between while I do my work, which that might be, you know, part of a challenge, but it doesn't have to be. And they do just as well as people who have, you know, finished their service or have, you know, had a trauma that's from a long time ago.
You know, it's a great statement of hope in that one of the reasons for doing the podcast series is that there's a lot of these things we just don't know and workers in the field don't know. And so to hear someone like yourself say, well, in actual fact, with the proper trauma therapy, you can get back to doing the work you love and be better equipped to deal with it. It's not something you hear very often, you know, in the circles that I mingle in. I very rarely hear anybody say, well, yeah, let's get these people. So, you know, do you feel that, how would you put it, that we're just kind of only really waking up to, one, we need to do a lot more, but secondly, that there are actually therapies out there that if people knew they were there, would actually access them more.
Yeah, I think there is a lot to be said for people kind of knowing what's there. And even though some of these therapies have been around for a long time, it just sort of seems to be something that isn't there in the general population. I think people who work in mental health kind of think that everybody knows this, but certainly that's not my experience of, you know, I was talking to an osteo, young guy, finished his degree a couple of years into his work, and he didn't know what cognitive behavioural therapy was. I said, oh, wow, that's really interesting. Whereas I assumed all people would know all different names of therapies and what they were, but the general population, getting it out there and kind of getting it to stick, I think, is part of the challenge. I know within the military community there is a lot of promotion of mental health, phone numbers given out, that sort of thing, but it's probably not necessarily that something that people engage in if they don't need it, and that the time that they need it, it's actually hard for them to recognise that they need it. So there are lots of challenges around how it's out there, but certainly the more professionals know and think about, oh, is this potentially a trauma kind of presentation that I'm seeing in front of me, that sort of thing, I think that can be helpful. And the more kind of family and friends know, oh, maybe this is trauma, to put that to someone might be difficult, but, you know, that's something that can be, I think, a really important thing.
Well, and John, you touched on before about the, you know, the culture of the organisation that you work for, all the context that the trauma occurs in, and you know, and that's the area where that, how would you put it, the promotion of, well, you know, and I battle it all the time, you know, that promotion of, well, yes, this work will expose you to trauma experiences, but don't despair. If you take the right steps at the right time, you know, we as an organisation can give you a lot of support for that. And that's where I think we've been so far behind. We're just starting to read now in terms of awareness of, well, what do we do with all these officers that leave this work, and any first responder, you know, really quite psychologically damaged, you know, what do we need to do? So it strikes me as that a core issue of organisations taking it on. As you said, the therapies have been around for years, but no one ever thinks to use them. And I see people all the time, I say, well, you know, where would I go anyway? Or, you know, I ring up and I can't get an appointment for 9 months, or I can't afford it. So there's all these sort of roadblocks almost in a way that, as you said, that just prevent people getting there. So can you just tell me a little bit more about the police? Because, you know, I've seen a lot of police myself. In terms of the level of trauma they get exposed to, which sometimes when I sit with them, I think, you know, my God, I can't imagine what it would be like to be going through these experiences. How back then, working within the system, how did you kind of connect? Because you're working in the system and you know the system, but then you're seeing these officers that are highly traumatised. I mean, did that throw some dilemmas at you about what we need to be doing or should be doing? Or that was a long question. Apologies for that.
Yeah, I think... within the organisation, some of those sort of cultural things around, like, if I'm, you know, if I take time out to do something for myself, look after myself, then I'm letting my mates down, I'm not part of the team. Those sort of things are often challenges. I think within all organisations is always a challenge of sort of, also, this happened because of the work, and that kind of, I think the concerns with organisations are often around litigation and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, those sort of things can be, I think, sort of hindrances for mental health being promoted. I guess within the culture of clinicians who work in those areas, it's often about, you know, can I, you know, push this person to do therapy? And sometimes, you know, when the therapy requires you to talk about things you don't want to talk about, that factor of avoidance is there in such a way that not only is the client steering around it, the therapist is steering around it, but the organisation is steering everyone around it. And, yeah, you've seen lots of bad things. You've seen multiple things. You've seen things that just are really unpleasant. But, you know, they have, what gets sort of lost in all of that is they've continued to work through that. So there's some resourcefulness there that's actually quite, you know, quite important, and that could be turned towards you actually feeling better. And that those are, I guess, sort of challenges which exist in everybody doesn't want to talk about this because it's actually unpleasant, uncomfortable, and even sort of the organisation can be like that in ways.
Well, and I guess when you know, you throw on top of that the vulnerability of your career, and I know with the police, through my own experience, of the issue of having access to a gun and, you know, the complexity of that for somebody, you know, at that sort of a level. So that adds, I guess, another reason why you'd avoid it in terms of, well, not only is it painful, but it could in some ways jeopardise my career. Yeah, I don't know the way around that.
A difficulty, and it's certainly sort of in terms of the overall kind of mental health picture, and this would go across all kind of first responders, because that was the sort of stuff happening in the military as well, where, yeah, if I talk about that I don't feel great, that I'm not always feeling like I can function, you know, is my career at risk? But certainly in terms of the research that I know around cognitive processing therapy, but I think it's also the research for a lot of the trauma-focused therapies, is that even people who have like high levels of risk of suicidality, that sort of thing, when they get into treatment, all of that actually reduces down and it decreases their risk. And certainly, yeah, those things like access to guns do need to be managed. But also, I guess that also does tie into what does that mean in terms of, I'm now no longer able to kind of do my job in the way that I wanted to, or the way I think it should be done, because that's part of it and I don't really want to sit at a desk. But those things can also just be managed in terms of, they can be temporary and you can be back at work. And
it's interesting, isn't it? Because if that was sort of the norm of the, look, you know, any officer or first responder is going to have times where the impact of the work gets on top of them, and we've got temporary solutions. It might be, well, while you're undergoing treatment, that you don't have, you know, you're not out on the road, or you don't have access to your gun, or you're not out you know, making life and death decisions as a paramedic or whatever. But with, you know, that help of the treatment and the involved professionals, there's no reason why you can't be reinstated. I'm not sure that's really there. I don't know, I'm interested in your thoughts. I often have people feel it would be the end rather than connecting good treatment with getting back to, you know, maybe what they were doing. Well, I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think people do kind of think, you know, oh, you've had trauma, you've got PTSD, that's it. That's the end.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely not. And, you know, I've seen plenty of police members that have gone back to work. I saw a long time ago, I saw a school teacher who, through an insurance company, who said they didn't think she was going to go back to work. She loved her job and she got back to work. Became the principal of a school.
Don't say the school.
No, that's not in this state. But I guess, she actually gives me permission to talk about her because she's had such a good experience. Yeah. And actually, I can add a little bit to that in that I've never sat in a room with her. We did all of her treatment via telehealth.
Wow.
And she did amazingly well.
Yeah. And I guess that captures that if you love the work and you know, I'll often ask people that, you know, do you really enjoy your job? And, you know, if you get that positive, yes, I do, well, then that's massive, isn't it? And then you've got the resiliency. Well, what's got you this far? You've been an officer for 15 years. How have you navigated through that? So that's very optimistic, isn't it, with that? Then, okay, well, let's start dealing with the impact of what you've experienced. So maybe we fast forward a little bit. At what point did you decide, gee, I wouldn't mind going into private practice and developing my own business? You know, what were the thoughts that were driving that?
They were really around how much is trauma focused kind of therapy out there really being delivered, and you know that a lot of people I would see had been seeing people for a long period of time, and not understanding that like trauma focused therapy you can be treated in cognitive processing therapy. 6 weeks is how it was developed. It was, you know, twice a week in there working hard, and yeah, there is hard work to do and it's not necessarily feeling great, but that you can turn something around in a short period of time, that sort of you know, goes against the grain for a lot of people. It's like, well, really? But yeah, people can move on. No, they're not completely cured as such, but you know, people can leave with no symptoms.
It's interesting, isn't it? And, but don't you go for a couple of years? No, we have a shorter term or what? So tell us a bit about, so you decided to set up your own business and to focus on trauma. Had you come in touch with cognitive processing therapy prior to that?
Yes, so I'd been doing cognitive processing therapy since about 2007, I think I was trained. Then in about 2014, I think I went over to America to be trained as a trainer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd been working with traumatized people for some time and liked it so much to see people actually have changed, and quite often, you know, that they'd been struggling with things for 20 years and then to see that turn around. It's a very satisfying thing, so I wanted that for more people.
Well, and I'd imagine that would have really, reinforced your belief about, well, you can be in therapy but not really address the trauma issues so that you're in therapy for a long time but you don't actually get any better.
Yes.
So I'd imagine then that those experiences really then confirmed that belief. Now, hang on, we actually really need people need to be a bit uncomfortable in terms of if we're going to get anywhere with the trauma. Was that sort of...
Yeah. And including the therapist needs to be a bit uncomfortable and go, okay, yep, if this is going to change, avoidance is the biggest part of this and we have to approach it. And of course, who wants to approach something that's uncomfortable? Mm. No one. But if you do that, the payoff is actually really big.
Mm.
And sometimes people just have ways of avoiding it that are... you know, very charming and engaging and chatty and but their life's stuck. They walk out of your room and they're still stuck. And when you see people get unstuck, it's, you know, quite different.
So what, from a personal point of view, you know, what, over, these are always hard questions to answer, but over, you know, how did you get yourself into the space that, yeah, okay, I can sit in this situation with you and I can kind of encourage you to go to places that you don't want to go to, but I can do that with you. I can, you know, is that just evolve over time or?
It's certainly, evolved, grown. I've probably maybe become more confident in it.
Yes.
I guess the first part of it was sort of understanding trauma and what PTSD is, and that this thing called avoidance is sort of so there and often so subtle, but that if I sit with that, people get change. And the research and looking at the research and seeing what happens, that kind of helped in terms of, okay, yeah, this doesn't feel comfortable to do, and sometimes, oh, am I doing the right thing or not? But doing that and then kind of processing my own discomfort, thinking that through. Sometimes I would even do the worksheets that I would give clients and go through that and kind of think, what am I worried about with this person because they've been living with trauma for 20 years.
Yes.
And I just want to talk about it. It's already repeating on that. We're just being a bit more kind of strategic.
Yes.
Kind of those sort of things help to grow. But then as you see clients come back and feel better, it's like, oh, yeah, it actually works. Yep, it works. Yep. Yeah, I feel uncomfortable, they feel uncomfortable, and it works.
But you then start to get confidence in what you're doing. And there again, as you were talking, that the importance of someone coming to see you, trusting that you know what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think,
I don't know what you're doing, but I trust you do.
Yeah, and I think that probably comes across, my guess is for my clients, it comes across in lots of subtle ways because probably the way I talk about the therapy, the enthusiasm, for want of another word,
yes,
that I guess the conviction I might have probably comes across in subtleties where I'm not kind of saying, well, look at this bit of research or that, although I will often kind of cite that stuff. But I think, yeah, the more you kind of understand that, yes, this is uncomfortable for the client, but it can have a big change, then that gets communicated in some way.
Mm. So maybe I'm a client that knocks on your door and says, John, I've worked in the police for 10 years and then I moved to the military for another 5 and I'm now a paramedic, but I'm not doing too good. What would you do with me? What would be the steps of CPT?
So, well, first we kind of look at, okay, is this absolutely got PTSD in there?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, one of the things with PTSD, my memory, if it's a man, it's 88%. If it's a woman, it's 79% of people who've got PTSD have another comorbidity. So quite often it's PTSD and depression,
right,
but it could be substance use. It could be all sorts of other things. But the first sort of thing is, okay, is this thing called PTSD in there somewhere? Often it actually is a really significant contributor to everything. So the first kind of thing is, okay, well, you've got yourself to my door, so I'm presuming that if there's depression there, it's not so bad that you can't do therapy because you're getting yourself to my door. So it's sort of sorting that out and going, okay, yep, this thing is called PTSD. Do you actually know what this thing is? Because people, you know, well, this is, oh, I just don't feel like I'm connected to my kids. I don't feel like, you know, I can trust my wife. This is all just kind of built up over time. I go to work, but don't get anything from it. I used to love it. I feel like I should. And there's all this sort of dialogue there of all the kind of bad stuff, which we would call symptoms, but it's kind of sorting that out for them to go, okay, so this is something that's going on for you. When it's something like somebody who's been a first responder, if they've had a life before that, that's often quite good in terms of, so what was life like before that? So something changed. Mm-hmm. So this is where you were exposed to trauma. That's a bit more difficult when someone has had childhood sexual assault, but they can still kind of understand that maybe their experience of trust or safety is different to their friends, that actually they have much less of those things than their friends do. And it doesn't sort of always fit for them in situations. So first is that, and then it's about really kind of explaining. So this PTSD thing, you steered around it in lots of ways, you know. I remember in the police force talking to members who had shortcuts around the Westgate Bridge. There are no shortcuts around the Westgate Bridge. that's avoidance. And, you know, once they understand kind of what PTSD is, then, okay, this thing of approaching it is what does change it. Kind of, are you ready for that? And then if they are, let's start. And some of the...
So I'd imagine that's quite a, quite a process for people to connect with something that, or feelings they've become used to as, well, I just hate going to work, but I go because mm-hmm. I have to identify, hang on, is this something that's more significant? Mm. And then I'm actually sitting with you and you can maybe help me do something about it. I'd imagine that's quite a quantum process for people to connect with.
Yeah, it can be. I think a lot of the things that I would say that I think people kind of focus on, present with, is that how their relationships have changed.
Right.
And that it looks like it's more like relationship problems than trauma problems.
Yes.
And like, I'm not connected, I'm this sort of stuff. Like, yeah, my relationship with my work that I used to love, that I used to get a lot from, get something back from, now it's just, you know, going through the motions. To actually understand that's because of trauma, because it actually feels like it's about, why have my relationships gone bad? Yes. Why do my kids not like me? Is this just teenagers, or is this just something to do with me?
Yeah, and I guess, and if you've grown up with the belief, or from a work point of view, that the work doesn't affect you, that you can be a policeman, you can be a correction officer, you can be in any of those positions, professions, and you just keep jumping up and getting back on the horse, and away you go. I guess that's the challenge also, to go, okay, oh, maybe this work has affected me because I didn't think it had. I mean, are they the sorts of dilemmas that people have to go through?
I think so. I think there's a sort of a tacit, they know it's affected them, but they don't want it to have affected them.
Yes.
And they want there to be some other explanation.
Yeah.
And very often it's tied up in sort of like a dialogue of, I shouldn't be feeling this way.
Yeah.
And it just goes around and around in circles. Like, I shouldn't be feeling this, I shouldn't be feeling that, I shouldn't be feeling. And rather than, what am I feeling and why am I feeling it? Oh, maybe this is, you know, because that intrusive image came in and then I thought about that. And then, and of course, that's all happened split second and they're in a different headspace and emotional space. But understanding, oh, I'm allowed to feel these things and move on. Because the culture is, you know, one where it's actually kind of important in sort of first responder that we can't, you know, sit down and process our feelings when we actually have to respond. But we don't end up not doing it afterwards either. But like functionally, I can't kind of sit down and go, oh, really? That was a really awful thing that I just sort of saw. I need to be responding to it. So, you know, part of the difficulties are that functionally we can't pull out the beanbags and say, those guys shooting at us, that was really nasty. You know, we've got to defend ourselves and look after others, but it's that time after where it doesn't necessarily happen.
It's just a crucial issue, isn't it, that yes, you're wired to do your job, and that's the primary thing. And every first responder, correction officer, police officer I've ever met, that is the key responsibility that they feel and that they respond to. But then the afterwards is often just a shambles of, you know, debriefs. And I've had some people say, well, the debriefs are never psychological. I've had a lot of officers say they actually re-traumatised me because I've got to go through what happened, but there's no space for the psychological. It's, well, here's the AP card, give them a ring, you know. And then life goes on and the next robbery occurs and out you go. So that's probably one of the most critical issues of post-incident, what do we do?
Yeah.
So I've gone off on a tangent again, but in your own opinion, what difference if that was dealt with better? You know, if there was another police car that could go out and the officers that needed to be debriefed could be debriefed and given space, what difference do you think that would make?
Well, I think the sort of social support side of things where you know, that debrief is maybe kind of the informal kind of thing, and the ongoing nature of that that social sort of support, that's where the research says that everything is really you know, good in terms of outcomes for people after. And I know from my own experience in the corporate field, I used to turn up to critical incident that happened in an office block All the white collar workers are distressed, don't know what to do. We'd turn up, they'd come and see you individually, and then they'd start opening up about all sorts of other things. And then I'd go out to a blue collar truck driving kind of place. The managers had organised a barbie for everybody. They're going to sit around and just chat about whatever. And it might come up that, oh yeah, that accident, that was pretty bad. Yep. But that would happen, you know, the week that it happened, then the week after there'd be another one, let's just catch up. Sort of that informal kind of thing. And they would often do it a lot better.
Yes.
Because there was that support there. Yep, bad stuff's happened and we're still doing our work and there's space to talk about it if we want, rather than I, you know, need to present in a certain way and do my work and that sort of thing. And then when I get this opportunity to talk, I really open up. But I'm not doing that at work. I'm doing that with a specific person, and then I need to kind of do more of that. But in that kind of EAP context where you turn up, that doesn't necessarily happen.
Mm.
But yeah, certainly the social support, and in terms of the research around PTSD, that post-trauma experiences where people can, you know, cement bad stuff that leads to PTSD if they don't have the right sort of support. So if that debrief is kind of something that's thought of as more ongoing, and that the social support needs to be there, and that's part of that's maybe cultural change that's not just in organisations but kind of in cultures.
I absolutely 100% agree, and you know, it just seems to be one of the biggest challenges. But anyway, back to I've convinced you that I have PTSD. What's the next step for in the process?
All right, so you've convinced me you've got PTSD, you understand what it is, and then I say to you, okay, we're going to do this. So is that right? We're going to do this? If I get a yes, then it's like, okay, so I need you to come in twice a week at least. And in that twice a week, we're going to talk about this trauma. We're going to focus on, well, you know, you might have had multiple traumas, but we're actually going to focus on one. And we know that this works when, and sometimes people say, oh, well, I've just got so many, I can't choose. We work out how to choose something. We will actually monitor what's happening with your kind of PTSD symptoms. So we choose one, we focus on it, and then twice a week for 6 weeks we are in there, and you're going home and you're writing about your kind of understanding of your experience. In cognitive processing therapy, we get to this, we don't necessarily have to go through the whole story of trauma. So in like prolonged exposure, you go through in detail talking about the trauma. But in cognitive processing therapy, we talk about your understanding of the trauma. It's still a trauma focus. Initially, we get you to write an impact statement, which is not what happened, but kind of the impact of it, how you understand why it happened. So that's the sort of first thing. And then we start to look at, well, what is your understanding of why this event happened? And often with PTSD, there is a lot of things that are to do with kind of responsibility, blame, guilt, shame, those sort of things. And so we're working through those. When we get towards the last five sessions, we're looking at particular themes that are identified back in the 80s. We're looking at safety, trust, power and control, esteem and intimacy. So when we look at those five things, we do that in relation to the client, but also in relation to other people. So feeling kind of safe at home by themselves, but are they worried about the safety of their partner, their kids, those sort of things. Trusting themselves, trusting their own judgments, trusting other people. Power and control, do they have a sense of, you know, agency in the world, or do they feel like everybody's got control of them? Esteem, self-esteem, positive regard, but esteem in terms of groups. So like, you know, like police members or military, you know, the military's just bad, other members are bad, people I don't know are bad, you know, sexual assault survivors, it's often men are bad. Military who've served overseas, it might be particular ethnic groups. It might be, it can be, I guess, many and varied. It might be kind of people who might have a beard or something like that. So that looking at how people have moved into groups that are kind of dangerous and just fit in this bad category. And then intimacy, we're looking at not just intimacy with a partner, not just sexual intimacy, but also emotional closeness, but that range from, you know, talking to the neighbour and having some sort of connection to talking to the postie and having a little bit of a connection to, yeah, an intimate connection with your partner. We're also looking at sort of self-intimacy in terms of how do you soothe yourself and manage your emotions and tolerate being by yourself if that's kind of an issue. So we look at all those areas. And all that happens pretty quickly. I might be having a discussion with you about, so how much time do we have? What can we fit into your timetable? And there's some research coming out on this, but occasionally I will do CPT in a couple of weeks. And so that's like every day. And the person comes in, we talk about the issues, they go off, they write about the issues. And when they write about the issues, we are actually kind of trying to explore what is keeping them stuck, what are the sort of things. So in the culture of, you know, I shouldn't talk about my feelings, well, that's probably going to keep you stuck with feelings. It doesn't let you process them. So we'll talk about how does that belief sit there, what makes it sit there, why does it sit there, and is that actually kind of completely 100% the way it is? And so we break down kind of as many of those sort of beliefs as possible, and often there are beliefs tied up in particular incidents that create the story that's not the story that everybody else has seen. Everybody else has seen, you did a great job, but that's not the story that gets repeated. And so we pull that apart, and that can happen in, yeah, a really quick time if the person's kind of ready to go, okay, I'm ready to do this. It will be not necessarily feeling great.
No. Well, I was just thinking as you were talking, you know, it's sort of in a way spreading out into all aspects of your life and self-belief where the trauma has probably been influential. So I would imagine that could be quite almost exciting but overwhelming for people to, because there'll be all areas that have been blocked. Like relationships and intimacy, all of itself, what their thoughts are about themselves is failure, all that sort of thing. So is that where you start to see a little bit of the spark, a little bit of the, I'm actually starting to get an understanding of this is bigger than what I thought, even though I feel bad?
Yeah. Often you see a change, even sort of as early as kind of four sessions in, when you're pulling apart something about how the trauma is stuck. As the sort of the focus on the trauma seems to kind of spread to so many things. But when you kind of get a moment around the trauma where somebody sees it in not just one way, but has access to a little bit more of something else, that, oh, maybe it wasn't just all about me. Maybe there was somebody else involved, something like that, that, you know, something like guilt or shame shifts and the look on their face shifts and emotions sort of flow from that.
Wow.
Because traumas are tragedies and they just do feel bad and they have a lot of grief, a lot of loss, but often that's stuck behind a wall of shame and guilt and things like that. And that kind of moment shifts things, and then it broadens out into all these other areas where things change. Where, oh, yeah, I can now talk about this with my wife and, yeah.
Wow, you know, just a question that relates to that. Often people that are in physical danger where their lives are at risk, you know, correction officers, police officers. Sadly these days, you know, emergency staff at hospitals, paramedics are more now going to dangerous sort of situations, and that element of significant risk in military, obviously. How does that come out in the therapy of that, you know, my life has been on the line and I've had to psychologically deal with that?
Often it's there in terms of a difficulty of kind of letting go, if you like, of some of the beliefs that fuel being hyper aroused, because you know, hyper-aroused, hyper-vigilant, hyper-alert, all seem to keep you safe. But in fact, they actually interfere with clear decision-making. But, you know, if I drop my guard, I'm actually going to be in danger, which means if I don't have my PTSD, I'm going to be in danger. It's not actually the case, because making decisions based on PTSD is not clear thinking. But those assumptions are there, and it's like, I'll be letting go of who I am as well. And that, you know, I've just been like this, and this has kept me safe, kept my family safe, kept everyone else safe. And it's, yeah, a challenge to kind of go, hang on, it might feel like that, but what are the other things that go on with this? You know, you can't switch off, or you get home, you know, you're on 24/7, so to speak, but it's not really 24/7. It's on all the time at work, and you get home and you're just kind of exhausted. And then you want to kind of hide and protect yourself, because the hypervigilance is still there. You've been exhausted by being switched on even more during the day. Or, you know, you are walking around expecting things to happen, and are they happening? Can we shift from that? They're all kind of really big things, because the assumption is that I've been walking around like this and that stopped it from happening. So shifting those sort of things are kind of, they're the big things that are quite difficult, because it kind of feels like this is who I am. I've learnt to be this. And these are good things, because they've kept me safe. They've kept my family safe.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking madly about all that in terms of, the hypervigilance, the survival mechanisms. I need to be hypervigilant in this job. People, and people talk about that. They can talk about their hypervigilance and not being able to unwind. But that's a really interesting idea of that. Then we're connecting that with, well, that's actually driving your PTSD, or your PTSD has become a mechanism. Well, that's how you protect yourself, you know, from all of it. There's not a lot done on that, is there?
There's
really not a lot of thinking going into any of that, really. Is there? No. Good. I'm glad you didn't say that there was a lot of thinking and I didn't know about it.
No.
But, gee, that's a real crux of what people have to do to survive with, in a way, with very limited weaponry to do it. Poor choice of word. But, you know, there's not a lot in the tank about how to do that. And so do you find that when people start to connect with, okay, I've developed a whole wide range of ways that of dealing with the trauma that ultimately haven't been terribly helpful to me, that they can lower their hypervigilance but still do the same work, can still be in the same at-risk situation but be more relaxed about it?
Yeah, they can. Yeah. In the moment they're probably not relaxed, but that would be a normal response. But it's being able to recognise that, okay, in the moment I'm feeling stressed because that is what's going on, and, you know, kind of I'm managing that, and then after the moment's over, now I don't have to continue that. You know, I'm back at the station. I can let go of that. I can actually kind of acknowledge that whatever I've seen, dealt with, has been bad, and I don't have to end up being hypervigilant about my own emotional response.
Wow.
Keeps it kind of going.
Yeah, well, that's terrific, because I often, because I don't have the knowledge, you know, you just get stuck at that kind of, this is how the person is. But to grasp the idea of it can actually help you in a way, rather than, okay, therapy's painful, but rather than it being a negative, it can actually help you to, it's really in a way self-teaching, isn't it? You're teaching people how to, the next time you're in this sort of situation where you've got more knowledge about you and what you need to do. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's, I think a lot of the times that, the first responder cultures, people in general, you know, are often thinking about task focus, what to do, rather than, hey, I felt that. That was okay to feel. That kind of matched the situation. It was a bad situation, and now I'm not in that situation, and I don't need to kind of defend myself against those feelings. That just does feel bad, and then I can kind of keep going with this and focus on the things that are actually important to me in the job, that what I did do well.
So that's the core thing, isn't it? In being able to address the reactions post-event in that day or two after, because often it's in the next event's already happened, but to recognise the reaction and then to be able to move to that was then, this is now, and I can let that go. Because the vast majority of people I've ever seen struggle with that enormously is that being able to go, okay, I don't need to be hypervigilant now. So in a way, that's teaching them how they can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, and it's I guess it's teaching them through kind of switching on the kind of thinking part of our brain to dampen down, manage that hyper arousal part of our brain, the kind of more primitive part, and by thinking it through. And you know, you can do that by, as you go into situations, once you've learned how to do that, yes, I've heard a code call, I'm likely to have my arousal go up, I'll think this through, and yep, okay, I've got through that code thing, that was unpleasant, that sort of thing, my feelings are around that are what they are, and that's okay to have. I don't need to have this kind of keep going on.
So we haven't finished my therapy yet, but I'll get back to that.
Yeah.
So in a way, I'm just sort of thinking someone goes into one of these occupations and, they're bobbing along and then, first trauma event, second trauma event. It's almost at that point, even though they might, I guess technically if they don't have PTSD at that point, but they have starting to have trauma reactions to the work that they're doing. If then it was sort of like, you never make it standard, but almost like sort of standardised, well, that might be the point that you go and go through a therapeutic process about, your response to the trauma incident or what's happening in your head.
Yeah, if it was normalised.
Yeah, the visions that you're getting, and it's all, part of it. And that teaching then occurs early in a person's career. It just hits me, it would then prepare them better for, as the trauma that's inevitably going to come, you've actually, rather than it's a 2-hour overhead slide presentation, which is often what tends to, we've already ticked that box. We've got someone in that's done a 2-hour, this is what happens when you get trauma. Most of us don't remember what was said 2 weeks later. That to actually experience that process of connecting your thought processes with what you've actually seen could be goddamn useful.
Yeah. I think that's probably where it's, peer support, that sort of thing, where it's that ongoing within the environment that could be good, and where it's normalised to, that stuff does feel bad and it's okay that you feel bad about that. That doesn't mean anything about what you did or didn't do. And there are kind of things that can happen in some of those debrief processes where, the focus is on the outcome and what we did rather than, actually maybe those two are not necessarily connected. We did, we followed the process, which normally has a good outcome, but this time it didn't have a good outcome. But in that process of looking for how do we get a better outcome, it can often be conveyed that you should have done something differently, that somehow you're responsible for that, rather than actually this work, it has bad feeling with it, and that's part of it. Let's look at, are there some things that we could have done, but also at the same time acknowledge that we don't actually always control outcomes. We move towards a certain direction that we hope for, but traumas are usually because of an outcome that people didn't want and nobody planned for, and and all the contingencies that were in place actually just didn't work that time. And, in that kind of searching for answers, which even in organisations that are not first responders, they have that process of kind of continuous quality improvement. Where can we change things to make things better for a certain outcome? And the assumption is that we will get that outcome, when that's not necessarily the case, and certainly in trauma, it's very rarely the case.
No, and that's what you're trying to teach people. And, I often despair, really, when I identify, okay, you have people go into these careers and 8-week training course. I know with the police it's a lot longer than that, but, you're still thrown in at the deep end. I don't care what anybody says. And then, I say, look, it'd be great to get the trainees back together at 3 months, 6 months maybe, to just talk to them about what trauma they've been exposed to, their first slash up or their suicide or whatever, just to have some discussions around that. Oh, that's impossible. You never get them on the same shift again. It's impossible to get the same group of people back. At best, you'd get five or six, and you could only do that in lockdown training, or, you know, there's 50 of my million reasons as to why it's not possible to do that. And, you know, logistical reasons. But there goes the opportunity missed, you know, there goes the chance to, and that's what you're saying really hits me, that, you know, if we actually provided better based psychological practices in known risk occupations, well, let's teach them at their first or second or third trauma techniques of how to explore it, you know, it just makes so much sense to me that that's what we should be doing.
Yeah, it does. I think it's very difficult within organisations, I guess. It's
there's just always 51 million reasons why something can't be done.
Yeah.
But in you sit with people with PTSD, you see the end result, you see what this work does to them. And to me, that makes it there's nothing more important. But anyway, back to my I really enjoying this conversation, John. So I've now started to respond to the idea that there's more than this than meets the eye. You know, it's not I'm just a hopeless policeman or a hopeless correction officer. What then happens is, because I guess by then you've got people engaged in the process.
Yep. So we work on kind of the core sort of things that might be keeping the PTSD going. So understanding the kind of beliefs that are really keeping them stuck. And in cognitive processing therapy, we do kind of think about people being stuck with PTSD. And that actually comes out of some research which they did on sexual assault survivors. And over 90%, I can't remember what the number is exactly, but over 90% of sexual assault survivors have the symptoms of PTSD in the week after.
Right.
But for most of them, those symptoms die off over time. Those who have PTSD just get stuck. And so we talk about, you know, how are you stuck? What is it that's keeping you stuck? And it's often, you know, some particular beliefs around how a trauma's played out or how they are in life, those sort of things. So we're focusing on that while we're at the same time also kind of moving into these five areas. And hopefully you're going home and looking at understanding your kind of thought processes a lot more, and that is also tied into a shift in how you feel on a whole lot of things.
So in some ways that's actually connecting with a person's natural resources to process these experiences. Yep. But if you get stuck at a point where then that needs to be unstuck.
Yeah. And we look at it in terms of, yeah, you're stuck with a set of feelings that are often kind of, they need to be processed, hence the word processing,
yes,
which is feeling. And they're sort of, you have your set of feelings that are to do with the trauma, and they're stuck behind your kind of belief system, which is generating a whole set of other feelings, which are usually bigger and worse.
Yes.
And once we process here, we move this out of the way, this stuff can start to come through, and processing that stuff is usually not as bad as the kind of stuff that people are stuck with. You know, something's happened because someone is just, you know, a rotten cop, they're bad, that sort of thing, and they get to understand, oh, hang on, no, these were just, I was following protocol, I was doing this, I was doing that, it just didn't turn out the way I expected it to. Understanding, okay, I'm not a bad police officer, this is just stuff that's to do with a job. We shift the feelings that go with that. Then you can actually think about what the tragedy is and feel that, and that shifts things. And there's often there's relief.
Yes.
You hear the word relief a lot.
Yeah, well, because people often do get very caught up in, did they contribute to the tragedy, or did they not do the push the button hard enough or fast enough, or did they not get there? You know, all those sorts of things that people go through. So it's and certainly get stuck on. So, yeah, it's a way of connecting them with, well, these are life or death situations, you know. Often we don't know what's going to be the right call.
Exactly.
Have you found then with clients that you've had that when they come back again because you know they've been in another major trauma that they're better equipped to kind of, it's a bit like, well, you're starting at one first time, but you're starting at five. So, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. Is it?
So, yeah, they are better equipped. So I'm sort of thinking of someone who they're a civilian and they were involved in several robberies working in a pokies venue. They came after the second one and then they came after the fifth one and then after the fifth one we did a lot more work and then they told me about one that was an attempted one that the venue had installed security where you go through like an airlock kind of door system, and so they stopped the person in that place. And the way he talked about that particular incident, and he didn't have symptoms that were to do with that, was very different to the way he was talking about the previous ones. And you know, he made a clear assessment of how it was managed, and rather than I'm not safe, you know, work's not looking after me, work we're doing everything to look after everyone. And you know, you could see quite a shift in the way that he was dealing with things.
So part of that therapy process is really that making those connections or opening up. It's really in a way providing a context for a person to start making those connections with the impact and the emotion and then that lowering of the hypervigilance and the stress levels. So many questions I could ask because it's just such a complex field. Would by the end of that therapeutic process, do people move out of a PTSD diagnosis, or is it, because I hear great varying opinions, you know, is it something they will live with forever, or is it something that people can move out of?
Okay, across all the trauma-focused therapies, about 2/3 of people are asymptomatic at the end of therapy.
Right.
12 sessions, sort of 15 sessions, that sort of thing, depending on the kind of type of therapy. I guess the sort of, I like to think of it in terms of significant life events. A lot of people would remember something like a wedding day. Sometimes they would remember it because an anniversary is coming up, even though they, you know, oh, it's January, so they know the anniversary is there, so it might just be on their mind. So there will be things that might trigger people. But the way that they manage that trigger is vastly different. It is like, oh, that's what happened. Yeah, I feel sad about that. And, oh, you know, I that's what I feel. That's it. I don't have any other kind of feeling. I don't need to come any worried about feeling sad about that. So people leave with, you know, being able to manage things quite differently. Some people with not at all. But I guess you can't say categorically that you're not going to have any kind of re-experiencing. That wouldn't be fair, because we all kind of think about things. Yeah. In fact, I recall this happening to me. I met somebody who I worked with about 25 years ago, and we were both at this particular event, and I started remembering some of the incidents that happened in that workplace, which I hadn't thought about for 25 years.
Yes.
They weren't particularly stressful or anything like that, but just seeing this person, I remember you. And then, you know, 25 years ago, I remember that happened at that workplace. Oh, and that happened too. And that's the nature of kind of memories, and these are significant memories.
Mm.
So having a different way to deal with those memories is something that's very big.
Well, and I guess it's that shift of, I don't need to be fearful of it because I know what to do with it when it comes, you know, and I've often heard it's going to come, you know, a flashback or a trigger or, but it's having that confidence, well, I've actually learned how to deal with that.
Yeah.
And I guess that's one of the huge messages, you know, for a lot of people listening to this that will be going, you know, I know what John's saying, I feel that, or I feel it's not quite right, but I don't kind of want to seek help. And I guess that's the major message, really, that the seeking help can actually be help.
And even the number of times an intrusive phenomenon, because it's not always a kind of flashback. Sometimes it's a sensory thing. Sometimes it's, you know, happens in a particular dynamic with an authority figure. It just sort of feels like you're back there. Mm. You know, the number of times that those things happen actually reduces down. And so, you know, it's not as frequent, but when it happens, you kind of have some way of dealing with it, which is quite different to an old response. So I had a client who summed it up in a really good way. He said, you know, when it happens, doesn't ruin my day, doesn't ruin my week, doesn't ruin my month, and that's what used to happen. It's like, okay.
Well, that's a great comment. yeah, but that's a great comment, and you know, in a way, it's what people hope for. You know, when they're at the bottom of PTSD, it's what they hope for. For that comment. Are you full booked out for months and months, like so many people?
I am, but there are a number of clinicians who work with me who are trained in cognitive processing therapy. Yeah.
What does someone do if they wanted to be referred for therapy?
So it probably would be good to talk with your GP. GPs mm-hmm. are good in terms of, you know, sometimes there are physical things that are also contributing to why you might actually be feeling bad. You know, often when people have PTSD, they kind of don't have the time to look after themselves, and some of those factors contribute. But your GP is somebody who can kind of monitor things, because, you know, if you're not a right fit with the clinician, go back to the GP and say, find me someone else.
Yes.
But yeah, you know, having a GP referral under mental health care plan is usually useful. And even with WorkCover, having the GP kind of coordinate those things, it's a matter of, you don't have to do that. You can come under private health insurance, those sort of things, but it's just a matter of ringing our office, really. That can start as easy as that. But having those sort of things in place around your physical health can be quite important. The way that particular mental health problems can mean that we just don't look after ourselves in the way that we could be.
And I think, as we've chatted, you know, the challenge for all of us is to, you know, play a role in shifting the stigma against counselling. And I often say people don't really understand what counselling is, and think it's a lot of things it isn't. Mm. Yeah. And that as counsellors we need to simplify it. And this is talking to a professional about your life and about the issues that you're experiencing. Do you want to just shoot out your phone number that people could ring if they wanted to?
So it's 0390770122.
Well done. Good work, John.
I hope that's right.
Now, I just want to thank you, and I'm just going to do a few closing words, because on EAP, and often it gets really confused and people go, well, they gave me a card. And I need to be very clear, you know, EAP is a short-based, generally up to 4 or 6 sessions, which has a very, very valuable role in all of first responder occupations, because they've all got phone lines, 24/7 phone lines. You can finish your shift. If you're really distressed, you can ring AAP and talk to a counsellor. It plays a very, very valuable role in all of these workplaces. But I have to be very clear, in my mind, it is not a trauma therapy model. It's a short-term model of care for events that don't need long-term therapy. Anybody listening is experiencing significant trauma reactions, EAP can be useful in the short term. For longer term work, like what I've chatted with John, you really need to embark on a proper trauma-oriented therapy, and I think sometimes the two get mistaken. So EAP, short-term, great service to get immediate support when you need it, and it can be very helpful. For long-term trauma, I really encourage workers to what John said, go and see your GP, talk about the significance of the impact, and look at where you can be referred to get specific trauma counselling. Enough of my preaching. Thank you very much, John. I've totally enjoyed our conversation, and often I have ideas and thoughts, but I don't have the knowledge to really quite know where to drive it. And I think some of the stuff we've talked about is a challenge for organisations to really start addressing. Mm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on this latest episode of Trauma from the Frontline. If you would like to get in touch with me, or if you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to email me at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Trauma from the Frontline. If you are enjoying this series, please make sure you follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you find this information valuable, we ask that you rate the show 5 stars. It really helps the show grow and reach a larger audience. Until the next episode, please take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, free counselling is available through your organisation's employee assistance provider, Lifeline on 131 114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636.